This is Continent of Media number 0407, produced September 14th, 2004. I also expect to release it sometime in the fuzzy future as World of Radio Extra 52. Otherwise, COM is a more or less sesquimonthly supplement to my weekly program, World of Radio. And Continent of Media is sponsored by Universal Radio for quality shortwave and amateur radio equipment. Check out their website and see about getting a catalog from www.universal-radio.com or phone toll-free 1-800-431-3939. Universal also sponsors DXing.com, where you may hear the latest edition of this program, read DX Listening Digest, and find much other useful information. Thanks, I think, to news search engines, our contributors come up with some interesting stories in very obscure publications, such as this one from the Pepperell, that's in Massachusetts, Free Press of August 4th, sent on to us by Andy Sennett and Mike Terry. It's titled, Pepperell Man Works to Keep Voice of America Active, by Don Erickson. During the Cold War, one beacon of freedom throughout the Middle East and Eastern Europe was the Voice of America. Between 1952 and 64, a key link in the broadcast chain was the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Courier, a vessel equipped with extremely high-powered broadcast equipment for its time that acted as a repeater from its berth in Rhodes, Greece. For 2 years, from 1958 to 59, David Newell, known locally for his bass boat repair business he ran after his retirement as an infrared research and development specialist for the Air Force, for those 2 years he was an electronic technician on the Courier. The title refers to his opposing the latest changes in the Voice of America's programming, but let's skip on to more info about the Courier. He's trying to contact older VOA crew members. His tour of duty is an interesting and little-known piece of American history. The 338-foot, 5,800-ton Courier was launched as a cargo ship for the Maritime Commission in 1945. In 1950, the Truman administration became interested in a seagoing radio relay station, and so the Courier was converted in 1951. The ship was fitted with three locomotive-type diesel engines to drive three 500-kilowatt AC generators, a 150-kilowatt medium-wave transmitter, two 35-kilowatt shortwave transmitters, and its own studio. When we were broadcasting, there was so much RF, it would arc through the wires of ships that came too close, he says, often starting fires. We could hold up a fluorescent tube and walk off the ship with it lit up. It freaked the Greeks out. At first, a 69 by 33-foot barrage balloon was used to fly broadcast wire, meaning an antenna, high over the ship. Newell said that stopped after two broke away, one of them later returned from Turkey 20 miles away, the missing pieces of material shaped as shoe soles. He also told a story about playing with Soviet jammers over 10 to 12 broadcast feeds from the ship, and one about an emergency trip to a Turkish cove to avoid a Soviet submarine that was allegedly sent to sink the Courier. Newell explained they had jammers on all frequencies and tried to pick up weaker feeds due to medium-frequency skips. Skips are signals, it's explained, that transmit into the atmosphere but come down somewhere else because of ionization. We were not allowed to broadcast in open water because that is illegal. The VOA archives in Washington have a stack of mail from people in communist Europe who were affected by the broadcasts. He says the 1992 Williamsburg reunion, we got a unit citation for our efforts in bringing down the Berlin Wall. The ship used to broadcast in 16 languages to the Middle East and former communist bloc 10 hours a day. The VOA still operates in 44 languages. When the Courier was decommissioned, her equipment was set up on a hillside on Rhodes. Newell spent a year repairing radio and radar stations up and down the East Coast before leaving the Coast Guard. Of course, the VOA still operates a medium-wave relay from Rhodes, not at sea, but on land on 1269 kilohertz. And as you may have guessed, I go far back enough to remember these seaborne broadcasts from the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Courier. In fact, I have a VOA QSL mentioning that in my collection. That was when they were still on shortwave, of course, and in fact, some country lists consider this a separate radio country, the Dodecanese Islands, or as I like to call them, the 12-ish Islands. The American public, of course, has an appalling ignorance of the Voice of America and international broadcasting in general. This was confirmed by the callers to a recent C-SPAN appearance by Kenneth Tomlinson. My remarks about that led to a bit of discussion in DX Listening Digest, first from John Filiozzi. That ignorance is ensured and reinforced by the Smith-Mundt Act, that's M-U-N-D-T. I guess we who truly appreciate and treasure shortwave and international broadcasting really have our work cut out for us. Actually, he was criticizing Mr. Tomlinson himself, not just the callers. Well, what is this Smith-Mundt Act? Ralph Brandy on another board's shortwave program says it's the act that says it's illegal for the VOA to broadcast to American citizens. John Filiozzi adds, furthermore, it's been interpreted to prohibit any contact whatsoever, mailings, schedules, materials, between a U.S. international broadcaster and the U.S. general public. The only exception, apparently, has been QSLs. The effect is that they operate in a cocoon outside the view of the U.S. general public. Mike Wolfson asks, have there been any recent attempts to overturn this legislation? In the Internet age, it seems to be anachronistic. At the very least, they should be accountable to the American people. Makes it hard to be held accountable when they're protected from having to talk to us. Ralph Brandy replies, I think the idea is to prevent the government from aiming propaganda directly at its own citizens. If it's anachronistic, that's mainly because government has figured out how to aim propaganda indirectly at its own citizens. And Mike Wolfson adds, the right-wing wackos want VOA to be propaganda. Very short-sighted thinking. It will come back to bite them someday. So, and John Filiozzi concludes, the intent wasn't as lofty as that. It was the price demanded by commercial broadcasters for not challenging the U.S. government's wartime decision to commandeer the former's shortwave transmitters. They didn't want the government to compete with them for stateside listeners. An early August story in El Diario New York, via Conexión Digital, written by Antonio Paneque Brizuela in Spanish, is about the betrayal of Univision Radio. Now, you've heard of Univision Television, but they are also building a radio network. And, in fact, of course, it's just a former competitor, HBC Hispanic Broadcasting. Well, this story says that the staff of HBC were promised that they would be respected, that their jobs were secure, and that they would even have the opportunity for professional growth under the new ownership. However, as soon as the purchase was complete, old employees started hitting the dust. Notably, in WADDO New York, one of the anchors there for the news, Pedro Vizcaino. This article says it's all about the various people's political connections, and says those who did keep the jobs are murderers of Cervantes, meaning, I guess, they don't speak Spanish properly. I've resisted the temptation to read this article in the original Spanish, where it has a much greater impact. However, you can reread it in DX Listening Digest number 4-1-2. And we have references for other issues of DXLD from which items in this program are drawn in the summary for this Continent Media 0407 via worldofradio.com. Most, if not all, American cities now have saturated FM bands, and that's also the case where you might not expect it, Honduras. Horacio Negro sent a story, dated September 3rd, from El Heraldo, a Honduran newspaper, in original Spanish, of course, so I'll summarize it. It says, adjudication of radio frequencies has been suspended, and some stations are being investigated for abuse of the spectrum. The increasing investment in the installation of radio stations all over the country will be paralyzed temporarily because of the saturation of the FM band. A decision has been taken by the CONATEL, the National Telecommunications Council. This will be reactivated after the use of the radio spectrum has been verified in all the cities in the country. CONATEL says the 88 to 108 megahertz range has now been saturated by FM broadcasting stations. However, there's still a demand for new stations on FM. So they need to determine the actual occupation of the spectrum to see if there are any places to put more stations. One possibility is that a station licensed on a certain frequency in one city might also use that frequency in other communities. I guess they're talking about boosters. There have been irregularities as existing stations jockey for position. One example is Discovery 99.1, yes, that's an English name, in Nakaome. The owner was authorized the low power of only 70 watts, but violated this by raising it to 1,000 watts. We also have an article from the August 5th Financial Times Mike Cooper sent us, this one in English, Good Morning Colombia, Radio Reaches the Rebels by Andy Webb Vidal. One demobilized FARC fighter argues that the government force's most powerful weapon is not armory, but the airwaves. Javier Tapiero, a 22-year-old rebel from San Vicente del Caguán in southern Colombia, turned himself in after tuning in to the country's third most widely heard radio network. The army says 30% of guerrillas who desert do so as a result of listening to Colombia Mia AM, the military's expanding national radio network, which broadcasts a blend of music, news, and soft propaganda. Mr. Tapiero says a lot of muchachos want to leave the FARC, but the comandantes tell them that the army will kill them if they do. I hope they hear that I'm all right, so they will desert too. Colonel Adalgisa Serrano, who directs the army's radio, says the idea for the network came from the FARC itself, which for years has operated its own pirate stations from the jungle. The army system has expanded from a set of low-range mobile transmitters in the late 1990s to a satellite link network of 32 stations today, including equipment that jams FARC transmissions. Throughout the day, the team of camouflage-clad DJs churn out a blend of popular salsa and vallenato songs, interwoven with messages exhorting listeners not to be slaves to the FARC in 8 indigenous languages. According to the Defense Ministry, 301 outlaws deserted in July, bringing the total for the year to 1,661. General Carlos Ospina, military commander-in-chief, says the balance of the conflict has shifted in favor of the state, probably irreversibly. He says, strategically, the FARC are on the defensive, which explains their sporadic tactical offensives. As I recall, most of these stations are at the top end of the AM band in the high 1500s. Sheldon Harvey in Quebec takes issue with a Canadian press story about code and ham radio in Canada, quoting the Radio Amateurs of Canada organization, saying it represents about 9,000 of Canada's estimated 45,000 ham operators. He says, I challenge the fact we have anywhere remotely close to 45,000 hams. What we may have, in fact, is an estimated 45,000 ham radio licenses, a very different animal. In the last few years, Industry Canada dropped annual renewals of ham radio licenses, issuing only licenses for new ham operators. At that point, it would have been safe to use a figure of approximately 45,000 licenses, not amateurs. It's always been next to impossible to determine the exact number of ham radio operators in Canada. The reason is, several Canadian amateurs hold more than one ham radio license. In Quebec, where VA2 was implemented, many hams already holding VE2 call signs applied to hold the same call sign but with a different prefix, thus resulting in two ham licenses for one operator. Also, numerous licenses and call signs across Canada were issued for amateur club stations, repeaters, packet stations, special events calls. Each of these, at least in the Industry Canada and now in the Radio Amateurs of Canada database, was taken to represent one ham operator when, in fact, that was far from the case. And because renewal of a license is no longer necessary, should a ham become inactive or die, it would be up to the individual or someone in his or her family to inform someone that the call sign and license were no longer required. On the WTFDA list, David Austin in South Carolina has discovered a phantom Canadian TV station. At least there's a website for no such station. www.upn11tv.com. Actually, it's a fan site, apparently, for a UPN station on Channel 11 in Hamilton, Ontario, but with U.S. calls, WJRN. Anyhow, he says, it is a very well-done site. We are in the midst of Continent of Media 0407, about media around the American continent, not necessarily shortwave, Our address, P.O. Box 1684, ENID OK 73702, USA, or WORADIO at yahoo.com. There are not supposed to be any broadcast stations on 1710 kilohertz, although new radios do tune up that high. In the northeastern U.S., people have been hearing a Jewish-oriented station on 1710. It's a pirate run by the Lubavitcher sect in New York City. There's been a lot of discussion of it lately on some of the lists, notably NRCAM and also the WTFDA AM list. It started September 1st when Dave Huckfelder in New Jersey said the Lubavitcher pirate is coming into central Jersey better than usual. It might be worth trying for if you're within a couple hundred miles. In Connecticut, Mike Bugay said, heard this one, tonight it's really loud and clear with no static at 10:05 Eastern Time. It's running S7, the strongest I've ever heard them, very clear audio, and at this time a guy was talking in English. How come this never gets shut down? Just wondering. Then Carl Zuck in New York replied, obviously the Lubavitchers have completed work on their recent construction permit. Just kidding. I was sailing in Westport over the weekend and heard them solid all the way down I-95 to Mamaroneck and then most of the way to my location north of New York City. They must have improved their operation since they're now quite strong here. Since they're on 1710, they won't interfere with anyone local. Unless someone complains in this day and age, they'll go on for years. They've been on a very long time now. Their audio can be described as what you might hear from a $20 cassette player when it is turned up as high as it can go. I presume it's a computer since the programming goes on forever, and there's rarely any form of ID. This should be an easy catch now, but what is the QSL address? I understand that someone once got an unsolicited QSL after someone from the Brooklyn station read a logging in the National Radio Club Bulletin. Harold Froge in Michigan even heard it, presumably, at 0530 to 06 UT on August 29th, a mix of somber and peppy tunes in Hebrew, was it, including some Harvey and Sheila-type tunes, no announcer. It was fair when listened to in upper sideband and steadily improved. Damon Castle then asked, does anyone have more info about the 1710 Lubavitcher? What is its exact location? How much power? Antenna system? I haven't heard it, but it seems to get a lot of attention and is relatively widely heard. How long has it been on the air? Has there been any enforcement action against it? The first reply from Brian Layton in California. The Lubavitcher pirate operates quite openly and claims to be operating legally. Most people doubt this due to the fact that they are received over such a large area. Some NRC members actually received QSL letters. Not much is known about the station except they appear to be from somewhere in Brooklyn, the power likely to be in the tens or hundreds rather than milliwatts. I do find it interesting they've not been cited by the FCC, but Chabad Lubavitch is very politically connected, so some may be inclined to look the other way. And since they use 1710, they probably don't interfere with much, so maybe that's why they've not gotten much attention. See the website www.radiomoshiach.org. However, that website refers to the frequency being 1620, so there may be more than one such station. Brett Saylor in Pennsylvania says, the FCC actually knows where the transmitter is and that it's unlicensed and illegal, so why is it still permitted to operate? A notice of apparent liability was issued in 2003. Now here it gets even more confusing because the NAL actually names something called Hip Hop Radio, but there does seem to be some connection with Lubavitcher Radio. It's almost certainly coming from in or near 770. That's the worldwide headquarters of Chabad Lubavitch at 770 Eastern Parkway in the Crown Heights neighborhood of Brooklyn, according to Scott Feibisch. The FCC does not have its own armed agents. It has to depend on support from local law enforcement and from the local offices of federal law enforcement if it hopes to shut down a pirate. There is no way the NYPD or the New York field office of the FBI would ever assist the FCC in taking any action at 770. The Lubavitchers are immensely well-connected politically in New York City, and any local politician who helped the FCC shut down the radio station would immediately lose a critical and very large block of votes. Brian Layton points out, the notice mentions a vertical antenna with a coaxial cable leading across the roof into a locked equipment room. When the FCC issues a notice of apparent liability, what happens? In this case, it was for $10,000. If it's not paid, then do they then place a lien on company assets? Assuming that someone at the FCC is doing their job, then just through the normal course of business, they should be placing liens, attempting to collect on the debt, and probably issuing more notices of liability, since the station has not ceased operations. But I cannot find anything on the FCC website besides this one notice of apparent liability. Dan Srebnik in New Jersey tells us there are two Lubavitcher stations in Brooklyn, one on 1620 and the other, more widely heard, on 1710. The 1620 station is likely located in the Crown Heights section, according to a knowledgeable source. Well, just who are the Lubavitchers anyway? Well, they believe that their leader was in fact the Messiah, even though he died a few years ago and has yet to return. Artie Bigley sends news of a slightly less unconventional medium wave station. It's from the Exponent at Purdue University in early September. A student-run AM radio station is to begin soon by Julie Glazer. This is in West Lafayette, Indiana. Beginning October 23rd, Purdue students will have an AM radio station to call their own. After more than a year of sorting through funding, licensing, and facilities obstacles, Purdue Student Radio, run by students for students, will begin broadcasting on AM 1610. Programming was still up the air, but might be diverse, including anything from hip-hop and punk to underground and international programming. Range will be about 1 mile around the campus, but also webcast www.purdue.edu/radio. Although Purdue has a full-scale public radio station, WBAA, it's one of few of the Big Ten universities without a student radio station. Joe Buck replies, when I was at Purdue in 1955, we had one of the first carrier current stations anywhere in the country using the call WCCR, Carry Club Radio, on 600 kilocycles. Pete Costello sends a story from the Berkshire Eagle, new FM radio station, races to get on the air by deadline, by Ellen G. Lahr. This is at Great Barrington, Massachusetts, a new nonprofit FM radio station, racing against the clock, trying to launch a low-power broadcast operation in time for an October 25th federal deadline. It's the Berkshire Community Radio Alliance, which was hoping to get a special permit for installing a radio antenna atop the Fairview Hospital, but there was opposition in the local community to locating the station there. The FCC has issued a license for the 300-watt station WBCR at 97.7 with a reach of 4 to 10 miles. But if there's silence on the airwaves October 25th, the FCC will revoke the license. Speaking of which, Mike Cooper sends a Washington Post story of September 2nd. FCC is asked to revoke the licenses of two D.C. television stations by John Maynard. Television watchdog groups, citing a lack of required educational programs for children, are trying to get the outlet's licenses revoked. The Office of Communication of the United Church of Christ and the Center for Digital Democracy filed a petition asking the FCC not to renew the licenses for WDCA Channel 20 and WPXW Channel 66. They say the two stations have not complied with the 1996 FCC guidelines regarding the Children's Television Act, requiring stations to air at least 3 hours of educational programming for children per week. The act has never before been cited in a petition to revoke a license. The stations presented three programs to the FCC as meeting the requirements: WDCA's animated action-oriented sci-fi shows Ace Lightning and Stargate Infinity, and WPXW's reality show Miracle Pets, which profiles extraordinary animals. The petitioners assert the shows do not meet FCC guidelines. They contain excessive violence and convey an antisocial message, and Miracle Pets is not specifically for children. And Gloria Tristani, the managing director of the church's communication office and a former FCC commissioner, says this is a good place to start holding stations accountable. The FCC has the opportunity to send a message that they're going to get serious about meeting their obligations. But the FCC is interested in children. They've set up a kids' zone on their website. These comments from Russ Johnson on the NRC list. I used to feel bad that the FCC was nothing more than a bad marionette show dedicated to ramrodding IBOC and Powerline Communications down our throats. Sometimes I'd get a little agitated that the FCC could care less about me as a lowly consumer. Even once in a while, I would become frustrated as they abdicated their obligation to enforce the rules and regs. But things are all better now that I see that the FCC is focused on the important things. They care about children. I'm feeling all warm and fuzzy inside. Well, here's what it says at www.fcc.gov/KIDSZONE. It's new, it's fun, and it's educational. The FCC Kids Zone is a safe place for children of all ages to learn fun facts about the telephone, satellites, fax machines, computers, television, radio, and much, much more. Guided by our mascot, Broadband, you can learn about the FCC, find out how things work, check out rumors, find out what some tough words mean, and learn how things we use every day were invented. In addition to all this, the website contains lots of interactive games and puzzles, surveys, telecom factoids, and much more, a useful tool for children to learn about the FCC and let the FCC know what's on their minds, and the site will reflect their input. So come into the zone. This was met by derision by other posters to the list, including Fred Vobey. Pre-election good time phony baloney feel-good legislation. As soon as the president is announced, the present FCC will be back to the same old tricks, modified only by what agenda Kerry might bring in if he gets elected. If Bush is elected, then it will be IBOC, BPL, and more consolidation. Look for radio, TV, and newspaper groups to gain strength. If the Green Party nominee, David Cobb, is elected, all radio stations will transition to NPR by 2006. And as part of children's programming, all TV stations must carry 2 hours of Blue's Clues and Barney Daly. Humor mode off. The Oklahoma Observer quotes the late Frank Zappa about the liberal media myth. The problem is that the whole myth of the liberal media bias is preposterous, because nobody who owns a broadcast license or a newspaper is a Democrat. They're all screaming on the right, and the flap about the liberal media bias was manufactured by the right wing. The right wing goes to some of their friends in another part of the right wing and says, "You attack my network, you say that CBS is too liberal, and that gives us the license to behave more conservatively in order to appear to be fair," thereby pushing any liberal idea completely out of their broadcast, and doing it in a way that's saying, "We're doing this to provide balance." And so, with that food for thought, standard disclaimer, Glenn Hauser here concluding another Continent of Media, number 0407, also to be known later as World of Radio Extra 52.